Gentlemen, yes, it's time for Uncensored Radio Free America. And on this fine network, Republic Broadcasting, we are here weeknights, 9 to 10 Central Time for the time being. We're entering our second month now of broadcasting here, and I am your radio avenger, Rick Adams. Well, as promised, tonight we are fortunate to have with us a very exciting and I think a very, very fascinating guest, one who certainly took it upon himself to write a couple of books pertaining to the 9/11 incident that we certainly have been talking about on this and every other program, I would say, in the talk radio land since the time began, actually, since the 9/11 attacks. And this author has written his second book on the subject, the first, The New Pearl Harbor, and the second one, just out this past year, of course, the 9/11 Commission Report, Omissions and Distortions. Our guest is David Raymond Griffin, and he is a professor of philosophy, as we say in English, of religion and theology emeritus from Claremont School of Theology in California. He's also author of 25 books, and these two, as I've just mentioned, his last ones. Hello, Professor Griffin.
Hi, it's good to be with you again.
Thank you. It's always a pleasure. We've interviewed you before, and it's nothing new for me, no new ground, but there may be a lot of new listeners tonight who are listening to this program, maybe even for the very first time. And just to warm things up before we take our first break, I'd like you to tell us, first of all, what motivated you personally with your background to write these two books on 9/11?
Well, the first one, The New Pearl Harbor, I was quite a Johnny-come-lately to this story. I didn't really start thinking seriously about it until about March of 2003. It was Paul Thompson's timeline that a colleague sent to me that finally got me interested. I'd looked at a couple things before and didn't think they were very impressive, but this was very impressive. And it just happened that I was to make a presentation on the Iraq War at the at my school. And so I made it on 9/11 as the pretext for the Iraq War. And at first I just thought I would write an article, but it got longer and longer and longer, and so pretty soon it was a book-length manuscript. And I was motivated to write it partly because although there were lots of people who knew a lot more than I did, some of them, like you said, started on 9/11 itself working on it, had seen through or at least strongly suspected and started looking for evidence for U.S. complicity very early. Nevertheless, most of those people didn't have the ability to get a book published on it. So I took it as somewhat of a duty just to try to publicize this work that other scholars had done.
And it became the book, The New Pearl Harbor. All right. We're going to take a quick break, Professor. We'll resume with your resume and the discussion in just a moment as we continue. I'm Rick Adams, Uncensored Radio Free America. Stay there.
There is a house in in New Orleans.
All righty. Hey, we are back and glad to be with you tonight. Uncensored Radio Free America. Rick Adams, your radio avenger here, and our guest, David Raymond Griffin. The book, The 9/11 Commission Report, Omissions and Distortions. David, in your opening introduction, you say something very interesting, and that is you talk about the fact that there are basically two theories about 9/11. Both of them are theories, as you point out. One of them is the official conspiracy theory put out by the government and the 9/11 Commission, rubber stamped by them. And this theory basically says that the attacks of 9/11 were planned and executed solely by this so-called Al-Qaeda terrorist network under the personal guidance of Osama bin Laden. Now, the other theory, or theories, if you will, is that the attacks of 9/11 were able to succeed only because they were at least facilitated by the Bush administration and its various agencies, NORAD and so forth, and basically allowed it to happen. At the very least, there are certain things we know that do not make sense about this whole 9/11 conspiracy theory put out by the government that have yet to be answered by either the commission or, quite frankly, the Bush administration. Now, is that a fair assessment of your introduction?
That's right, and it's most important to understand that these are both conspiracy theories, because many people think, oh, well, we can reject any accusation that the government was involved because that's a conspiracy theory and we don't buy conspiracy theories. But once you see they're both conspiracy theories, it's just the one was put out by the White House and the Pentagon, and the other was put out by people who found problems in that theory. Then you realize, well, okay, they're both conspiracy theories, so I guess they have to be evaluated on their merits, which one makes sense of the available facts the best. And as I showed in the new Pearl Harbor, there are dozens of facts well reported in mainstream sources that the official theory does not make sense of. That is, it is strongly in tension with them or even contradicted. Mm-hmm. And yet the 9/11 Commission, many people think, well, its job was to figure out what happened on 9/11, who did it, but not at all. They just take for granted the official conspiracy theory, completely ignore the other one, and proceed from there. So they don't examine any of the evidence that would suggest government complicity.
And look at the people who composed this commission right from the beginning. First, Mr. Bush wanted to pick someone that we probably never heard of before. That was Henry Kissinger, right? And all of his, panoply of ethical issues over the years as former Secretary of State and in other administrations. He was hardly the angelic being that one would look to supervise or oversee an impartial investigation. So that was dropped. Then he came up with, eventually, this former governor of New Jersey, Thomas Kane, and of course the people who composed that commission too, from both parties, basically having some, I guess you'd say they had some baggage of their own that they could honestly say was not quite totally dismissed or dispassionate on the issue. So, in other words, from what you say in the book and what I've read, this commission in itself was flawed right from the beginning.
Well, yes, and in retrospect, in a way, it would have been better if Kissinger had remained, because people know that he's, a criminal and a liar, and so it would have made it obvious. But by appointing kindly Thomas Kane, mm-hmm. and then this obscure person called Philip Zelikow, making him the executive director, which meant that he was in charge of the staff, and that's important because it was that staff of about 80 people who did most of the work. The people you saw on TV just took the results of what the staff had come up with.
Yes.
And Zelikow was then able to determine which subjects would be researched and which ones would be ignored, and he was also able to determine essentially what would go in the final report and what would be excluded. Now, the reason that's important is because Philip Zelikow, far from being some sort of neutral professor, is essentially a member of the Bush administration. So it's very little different than if Condoleezza Rice or Dick Cheney had been put in charge of the commission, because Zelikow and Rice served in the Bush 1 administration together on the National Security Council. And then they wrote a book together during the years the Republicans are out of office, and then she brought him back in to serve, to advise the transition team, and so on. So you really have, if you're asking, what about this alternative conspiracy theory that suggests the Bush administration arranged or at least allowed 9/11 in order to further its agenda in Afghanistan and Iraq and to build up the Space Command and so on. Who's going to investigate that? You essentially have the White House investigating itself.
Yes, exactly. And the Congress allowed this charade to take place with very little real opposition, except some opposition that looked rather partisan from the Democrats. It looked almost like a, you know, Republican versus Democrat, them versus America type of, if you will, construct. So it was a pretty well-staged event. I think most of us could agree that this report is as valuable, perhaps, as the Roberts report that came out right after the Pearl Harbor attack. And who did President Roosevelt turn to? Of course, Supreme Court Justice Roberts, and limiting the parameters, by the way, of his investigation right from the beginning. So it was rather obvious that there was something afoot here that did not add up. And yet, you know, the average person, although becoming more skeptical now with other reports in history, the Kennedy assassination, Pearl Harbor, and so forth, might be more tempted not to believe the official government version today, you find that whatever the government says, the media seem to pick up on it right away, as you've pointed out, almost as if it's gospel truth.
And well, even stronger than that, because they try to crucify anybody who challenges, whether it was the Roberts Commission or
yes.
the Warren Commission
yes.
or the Tower Commission, and now the 9/11 Commission. As you say, there's a long history of these
yes.
scandalous reports that simply ignore much of the evidence and distort the rest, and that's
yes.
why I call the subtitle of my book is Omissions and Distortions. Because that's what the 9/11 Commission report really consists of, if one knows how to read it. The fact they've omitted most of the crucial evidence, and then what little they do deal with that would point to the administration, they distort those few.
All right, we'll get into some of those as the program progresses. By the way, you listeners out there, if you have any specific questions, any general questions, anything at all you'd like to contribute to the discussion, we're fair game. We'd love to hear from you. Our toll-free number is 800-313-9443. Remember, 800-313-9443, and we'll get to you as soon as we can. One of the most glaring, Professor, omissions, if you will, or distortions, I guess the omission would be the proper word, is the very story of the so-called alleged hijackers, those that were actually and are actually, at last count, still alive. Tell us
that's
about
what when I got the book the day after it came out, and that was the thing that first struck me. I really couldn't believe it, because in my circles, in your circles, it's just common knowledge that at least six of these alleged hijackers who allegedly committed suicide on 9/11 are still alive and working. And some have been interviewed by British newspapers, and this has been discussed by the BBC. One of them walked into an American embassy and said, "What's this about my being dead?" And all of this. And I thought at least the 9/11 Commission would say, well, some of them are wrong. They were probably cases of stolen identity. But not at all. They go right down the line with the official story on all 19. And there's no question that of mistaken identity, because they give their photographs, they go into quite a bit of detail about their personal lives, their girlfriends or their families, and so on. And so you see from the very beginning, they're simply going to omit almost all of the rather standard news stories that that contradict the official story.
I mean, that's incredible when you think about just that one fact alone. That is a major, major, major issue with anyone with half an ounce of intelligence. And yet, who in the media, the major media in this nation today, has dared to pick up on that glaring contradiction?
Yeah, it seems, just you could point out without being critical or accusatory at least, you could say, well, you know, there's at least one mistake in here because they speculate that this certain hijacker was the one who probably stabbed a flight attendant on flight 11 shortly before it crashed into the North Tower of the World Trade Center,
mm-hmm.
and he's the one who walked into an American embassy.
Mm-hmm.
So the Americans know he's alive. It's it's a well-known fact. One can go down and interview him today, and yet nobody will say this little emperor has no clothes on.
Incredible. All right, we got to take another break. Professor David Griffin with us tonight. Give us a call if you have a question. We'll be right back. Rick Adams, Uncensored, Radio Free America. Hey, we are back with a never-ending story about 9/11. Now, it's been several years, and I know that most Americans have gone back to business as usual, and I think that's a safe bet to say that most of us are probably rather complacent and no longer think about 9/11 or even the threat of terrorism on a daily basis. And yet, we find that most people, when polled now, and particularly New Yorkers, say they do not believe the official government report. In fact, they do believe there is some FBI, CIA, NORAD, whatever, some U.S. government complicity in all of this. Otherwise, it never could have happened. And that's a fairly logical conclusion, is it not, Professor?
Well, yes, and this is extremely important because I've just read a book about the Kennedy assassination called History Will Not Absolve Us. It's by a psychiatrist,
mm-hmm.
and he makes the point that it's fine for people from the government's point of view to believe that President Kennedy was assassinated by forces within the government itself, and then that these governmental forces covered it up. But if they only believe it and they don't know it, they're not in position to act on it. And so as long as it's not publicly discussed, even though the evidence is now simply overwhelming, the evidence, additional evidence has come out in the last 10 years,
mm-hmm.
that there's simply no doubt at all. I mean, we can now say, those of us who know the facts, we absolutely know that the CIA, for example, was heavily involved in planning and covering up. Well, it's the same thing with 9/11. You can have, as you say, about 50% of the New Yorkers doubting the official story. But on the other hand, since it's not discussed, and most people don't even know about the existence, say, of my books or other books on the topic, and so they can't go through and really study, then they're not in position to know. And if you're not in the, if you don't know, you know, you don't think you know, well, you're not in position to do anything. you just, as you say, go back to business as usual.
Yeah,
so
shame on the media, because the media that's always looking for some tidbit allegedly to down George Bush with, I mean, Dan Rather could have, and this would have been just perfect grist for the mill had he really wanted to destroy this so-called Bush administration. I mean, you know, the media are probably more complicit than the government itself, because they have the resources, and yet they wouldn't touch any of these many, many gaping holes in this commission report. We haven't even scratched the surface. So, I mean, I just, the whole thing is laughable, had it not been so tragic. All right, we have Keith on the line, would like to say hello and ask a question. Hello, you're on the air with Rick Adams and Professor David Raymond Griffin. Okay, he dropped off. All right, you can come back on. We'll entertain you right after the break, which we have coming up in a few moments. You know, you discuss in this book many of these gaping holes, and one of them obviously has to be the whole business of Building 7, and how this building, we are now told by its owners, was deliberately brought down. But for months, and indeed over several years, we were told was a mysterious happening. In fact, we saw Dan Rather, and we watched him and others, other anchors, talk about this building. And you address it in your book as well. What is your explanation of this whole aspect that has been overlooked by the report itself?
Well, this is one of the greatest of the omissions.
Right.
Because to have a 47-story building in the middle of Manhattan come down after it was not even hit, it was two blocks away from the burning towers, this should have been one of the greatest stories in the history of the world, this building just mysteriously came down.
Yeah, one would think. Yeah.
And indeed, FEMA was given the task of explaining how it was that it collapsed. And, of course, the subtext was you need to explain how it collapsed on the assumption that it was not brought down by controlled demolition. Of course, nobody said that, but they didn't have to say it. That's
right.
The assumption.
That's the assumption.
That,
yeah.
That has to be accepted. And there is no way to explain how such a building would come down, particularly the way it did. It collapsed in about 10 seconds. And as you say, Dan Rather himself on the evening news says, boy, that looks just like those buildings we've seen too many times that are brought down by explosives.
Exactly.
So if you look at the video, you know, if the media would show people the video, many people, once they see the video, they say, oh, well, there's no doubt about it. I mean, clearly, that building was brought down deliberately. No fire could bring a building down that way. And furthermore, there were just tiny little fires on floors 7 and 12 of 47 floors, little fires that the fire extinguishers should have, the sprinkling system should have put out. So there was no reason for that building to come down, given the official story. And yet it did. And the 9/11 Commission, how did they handle it? They didn't even mention it. You can read that whole 567 pages, and it'll never once mention that Building 7 collapsed.
I mean, that's like, you know, a book on how to build a clock without mentioning a clock, you know? It's just amazing. All right, we've got a break. We'll be back with our guest, David Raymond Griffin, and his new book, The 9/11 Commission Report, Omissions and Distortions. I'm Rick Adams.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network, because you can handle the truth.
Okay, we're back on the program, Uncensored Radio Free America, right here on Republic Broadcasting. This is Rick Adams, and my guest again is Professor David Raymond Griffin. His book, The 9/11 Commission Report, Omissions and Distortions. Before we go back to the phones, Professor, you were just saying something about the fact that Building 7 obviously did not collapse for no reason whatsoever. It had all the appearances, and indeed we now know that the building was brought down deliberately by the owners. Now, in fact, The logical question would be, what is it about Building 7 that caused it to be brought down deliberately?
Well, I say, according to the official reports on it, there is no explanation. FEMA just says, we don't know. And the longer version, they said they gave a scenario in which they imagined that maybe some something that was burning fell from the north or the south tower, you know, those two blocks, went through the window somehow and started the fire, and then somehow lit the diesel fuel that was down on a lower floor, and that somehow that turned it into a raging inferno, and that somehow caused it to collapse in 10 seconds. Of course, the problem is that we do have photographs of the building that afternoon, and that it collapsed at 5:30, and it was not a raging inferno. The photos show there's only this fire on the two floors, a fairly small fire on each floor.
Mm-hmm.
And so the FEMA themselves said the only explanation we can come up with has a very low level of probability. In other words, we don't have a clue. And so, of course, the 9/11 Commission, they couldn't do any better, so they just ignored the question.
Well, in fact, they did not really interview experts who could have been brought into the commission to discuss these issues, just as many firefighters were kept from the scene, kept from the commission, who, as you know, many of them were and still are very bitter about the fact that they were ignored. Their statements about what they heard, i.e. explosions on various floors of those buildings, in fact, was testimony that was not to be allowed before this Bush commission.
That's right. They really only allowed government employees to testify.
That's just mind-boggling. I mean, how can anyone call that any kind of a report that could be taken seriously? Just incredible. I mean, Michael Rupert, I don't know, he said in his book, Crossing the Rubicon, I'm sure you're familiar with it, he said that Building 7 was the command center, which Dick Cheney and others had actually bypassed all NORAD and were directing the NORAD system to control it in order to commandeer these attacks. That was his conclusion, his opinion, based on what he pieced together, that this was the command center of the whole operation run by the government. Now, that's a pretty solid and shocking statement. If indeed it's true, I can think of some hangings that should take place, my friend. Let's take a call. All right, we have Joe. Joe from Rhode Island on the line. Hello there, Joe.
Hi, Rick.
Hi. Hey, you got a question for our professor?
Yes, professor. Are you familiar with the tower which was right along the West Side Highway? Which tower was that, the north or the south?
Well, I don't know exactly what you mean, but go ahead with your question, and then maybe I'll know which one you're talking about.
All right. There's one tower that went right up straight from the West Side Highway, straight up, I don't know how many floors it was. Was it 108 floors, the towers?
Well, there are more floors than that. But anyway, what did you want to ask about it?
All right. Here's my question. The news media showed me pictures of the towers pancaking and coming down, like mushrooming out.
Yeah.
All around. And yet, if the building goes straight up 100 and so many stories from the West Side Highway, I believe the sidewalk was about 12 to 15 feet in depth from the highway, and I drive this highway all the time. I don't understand how, if those pictures we saw were correct, how that the debris didn't come down and collapse two walkways that went from the towers, from the tower, across the street to those buildings across the street, about 75 yards away. They were aluminum towers,
mm-hmm.
And even today, if you drive by, you can look at those towers. They're all pit marked as if something hit them. But if that was the case, That building should have came down and actually wiped those things right out. They were right alongside of the building.
Well,
if those pictures were true.
Right. The whole purpose of controlled demolition is that you can make the buildings fall where you want them to, because you place the explosives in certain places, and then you set them by computer so they go off in a certain way. And so, for example, the photographs show that the South Tower, the top of the building, came off first and started to fall. It should have tipped off, you know, if it had been a normal sort of collapse, not artificially induced, it would have gone several blocks and destroyed many buildings. But then the way it was arranged, it nevertheless came straight down almost into the building's footprint. So this is the genius of controlled demolition, even with buildings this tall, is that you can make them come right down so they don't destroy the other buildings around.
Does that answer your question, Joe?
Yes, it does, Rick.
And so what is your conclusion, Joe? What is your own conclusion or your own feeling?
Well, I see devastation going four blocks the other way from the West Side Highway over.
Yeah.
But I don't see any devastation going the opposite way. In other words, from the West Side Highway the other way toward the Hudson River, there was nothing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, a few things hit that building across the street, another little major dam. And I drove by there the first when they opened it up to let the cars go through. I didn't see any damage. In fact, the street wasn't the same street. I mean, it was the crosswalks were the same. I said, look at this. This is amazing to me. And yet the devastation going the other way went four blocks.
Yeah, yeah. And your thoughts are, your conclusions are essentially that you believe this was done deliberately.
The pictures that we saw on the news media led me to believe, and I was in my mind, I was saying this stuff had to go into the Henry Hudson Parkway across the street, because they were showing it mushrooming out.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying? All the way around. So my conclusion is those pictures were frauds. They showed the world on TV.
Well, there's that thesis now, of course, that's been articulated by people such as Artie Wheeler and others now, who have suggested holography being used to create the illusion of planes hitting those particular planes hitting those towers. I'm not going to say either way. I mean, I don't think you have to argue on that basis. I think you can go far out on any particular premise without having to do that. All you have to do is just look at the gaping contradictions now. What the government claims and the laws of physics alone. These laws of physics and the laws of science, I think, would mitigate against this business of the way the planes actually would have brought down those buildings, and the fact that the fires, even many of the fires, were under control, and yet firemen were hearing explosives and what they claim were detonations going off. This was disallowed. This testimony was totally and completely verboten by the government. Yet we know interviews were conducted with them overseas. Der Spiegel. We saw these interviews in the London Daily Telegraph, the Scotsman, Korea News, Asia News, all these other papers. But the New York Times, the Washington Post, and all of this other tightly knit group of newspaper owners somehow just didn't feel the American people should be hearing those things. Why? That's my question. Why? Professor, do you have an explanation?
Well, on the question of the pictures, I don't believe they were faked. I mean, we just have too many versions of the same photographs. But certainly you do have those massive dust clouds coming out. And, of course, that's one of the characteristics of controlled demolition, is that these explosives turn the concrete, the cement, into very fine dust particles. And so that's all you had. And so although those clouds were going out several hundred feet, that doesn't necessarily mean anything was going to be hitting the ground other than a little bit of dust. And they could control the direction. And so that if what the gentleman says is correct, is the case, and I have no reason to doubt it, that also could have been planned, that all the debris would fall basically in certain directions and not the others.
You can go there today and or call somebody up, have them take some pictures of those crosswalks with the dents in them. Those things should have been wiped right out. I mean, steel should have hit those and wiped them right out.
Mm-hmm.
They were that close to the building. I mean, they were 10 feet, 2 feet away from the building.
Well, how about this one here? All of the steel girders, all of the steel from the structures of those buildings was very, very, very quickly taken and apparently sent to China, of all places, so that it could not be examined here, the joints and so forth, to examine the nature of what brought them down. Professor, isn't this another amazing story?
Well, yeah, and this gets us back to the 9/11 Commission report, because, as the gentleman said, the official, you know, it looks, the buildings are pancaking, and one of the insofar as there is a semi-official story of what happened, it is a pancake theory that somehow the planes crashing into the building caused a weakness under the top floors and caused them to collapse on the floors below them, and then they pancaked all the way down. Well, of course, one huge problem is how could they do all that in 10 seconds, virtually free fall speed?
Mm-hmm.
But even looking aside from that, that would be like with the old phonographs when the records fell down. You still had the spindle sticking up in the air. Well, in these twin towers, the unique thing about them, what was unique when they were first built, was that the core consisted of these massive steel columns,
right,
47 in each building. So they would have been sticking still 1,000 feet or so up into the air, even if the pancake theory were true.
Mm-hmm.
So what does the 9/11 Commission report do? They tell us, you know, they don't mention the problem, but they just say that the core of each tower consisted of a hollow steel shaft. And so they just wiped out those 47 massive steel columns, so there's no problem of how the buildings could collapse into a pile no more than 3 stories high. And as you say, the steel came down in conveniently sized pieces,
mm-hmm,
all ready to, most of them ready to cut, just put on trucks.
Yes.
And, of course, that's what the company called Controlled Demolition Incorporated advertises, that they can bring the steel down so that you don't have to cut it all up after it comes down.
Yeah, and here it was taken and shipped overseas, far away from the scene of the crime.
Yeah.
I mean, that's too suspicious in itself. No explanation, no logical explanation for why that would be.
They gave us... Yeah.
Hey, thanks for your call, Joe. I appreciate it. Well, Professor, that's not the only other major contradiction. You know, there's so many, I hardly know where to begin, but I think one that is just absolutely amazing is the fact that NORAD apparently was incapable of stopping even the second plane from going through the towers. That was just a little bit too much, especially since this had been, what, about an hour and a half after the first plane had already been seen to be diverted from its original path. I mean, how does that happen? How does that happen without there being some involvement on the part of the government?
Well, this is, for many people, this is the most convincing part of the story. Once they learn that there are these standard operating procedures, that soon as... there is some sign that a commercial plane has been possibly hijacked. That is, its transponder goes off or it deviates radically from course and they can't pull it right back. They lose radio contact. Then the FAA controller, who is assigned to that particular plane, calls the military and tells them about the problem. The military then is to call the nearest Air Force base that has fighters on alert, send up these two jet fighters, which intercept the plane. Normally this happens within 10 to 15, certainly within 20 minutes. And yet with the first flight, 32 minutes went by between the time of a warning and when it hit the North Tower. And then, as you say, even if they were asleep at the wheel then, there was no excuse for the second plane, which came in, about 10 minutes later. And so they had much more time. And yet no plane, no jet fighters were even close. So what does NORAD tell us? Well, they've given us three different stories now. And, you know, when a suspect starts giving you different stories, you begin to suspect you're not getting the truth.
Yeah.
So the first few days they told us, well, you know, we didn't really send up any fighters until after the Pentagon was hit. And so that was an hour and a half after the trouble first developed. Then critics came out and said, well, just a minute, why didn't you follow standard operating procedures? And within a few days they said, oh, yes, we did. We sent up fighters, but, you know, the FAA was very slow in notifying us. Instead of notifying us within 2 or 3 minutes, they waited 15, 20 minutes or even longer. And so we just didn't have time. Well, then the critics looked at the timeline and said, well, just a minute, you can scramble planes by your own websites to 29,000 feet in 2.5 minutes, and then these planes can fly 1,850 miles an hour. They should have gotten there, certainly should have gotten there to block the second flight, which hit the South Tower.
Yes.
So now the 9/11 Commission gives us a third story, which says, oh, no, the FAA didn't even notify us about that flight. And so we didn't even know about it until after the South Tower had been hit. They didn't notify us about Flight 77, and they didn't notify us about Flight 93. And then, of course, you have to forget the fact that the military has its own radar system, which is far superior to that of the FAA.
Yes. All right, we have to
that
stop
nobody
there.
Nobody was looking at it.
All right, hold that thought. We'll be right back with more. I'm Rick Adams. And we are back with a final wrap-up in this hour of the program, Uncensored Radio Free America. I'm Rick Adams, Radio Avenger. Our guest is David Raymond Griffin, author of the book, The 9/11 Commission Report, Omissions and Distortions. And, before we go back to the phones and speak to Jane in Maryland, Professor, you were pointing out the three different scenarios, three different stories that had nothing in common, and yet we were hearing also that there were possibly as many as five drills being conducted on that day of 9/11, including the very scenario which just happened to happen.
It's very interesting. Cynthia McKinney finally got a chance to interview Rumsfeld and General Myers about this, and their reply was, oh, well, NORAD, the military, we weren't in charge that day. It was the FAA. It's just incredible, as if the Federal Aviation System Administration was somehow in charge of responding to the terrorist attacks. And that's typical of the 9/11 Commission report. My final chapter, in fact, is called The FAA Taking the Fall.
Yeah.
The commission simply makes them look like absolute buffoons, as if everybody worked for the FAA is completely incompetent, and this is their way of getting the military off the hook.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and of course we haven't even scratched the surface of the rest of this whole business of the Project for a New American Century and what is now going on in the Middle East as part of a concerted effort to basically use 9/11 as a pretext for war. Now, we have Jane on the line from Maryland. Hello, Jane, quickly.
Yes. Immediately when they announced that the Pentagon had been hit, about 9:40 that morning, initially they said it was a truck bomb. I was in downtown Baltimore at the time, and I had listened to the live broadcasts of the plane sitting from a talk show host in New York City.
Mm-hmm.
Then subsequently, by about 10 of 10, we were told that, no, it was not a truck bomb at the Pentagon, but rather it had been hit by a plane. And immediately that triggered suspicions in me because Andrews Air Force Base is right down the road.
Uh-huh.
There's always several combat-ready squadrons ready there, especially on days when an important dignitary like Tony Blair or if the president was flying out of D.C. that day to be down there in Sarasota with those school kids. So yeah, I knew something was up. I said, if this was a massive, I said, what the hell's happening here? Where was NORAD? I said, if this was a massive screw-up, heads are going to roll. There's going to be court martials. It's going to be a massive scandal.
And besides which, the Pentagon has its own battery of defense mechanisms that wouldn't even allow a plane
absolutely
to come near it.
I had read about all this. Remember the sensationalistic stories
in
the Daily News about the G8 summit, how they had ringed it because they were afraid of somebody flying a plane
sure,
into it?
Sure. Very quickly, though, we're almost out of time. Professor Griffin, a response?
Well, it's very interesting because the 9/11 Commission in their report simply ignores both of these facts that you've mentioned and simply makes no mention of the fact that any commercial plane coming close to the Pentagon would have been shot down automatically by the missiles surrounding it.
Mm-hmm.
And likewise, the other point she makes, they also make no reference to that at all. So one more illustration of what a massive cover-up the 9/11 Commission report is.
We're out of time, Professor. It's been a pleasure. We'll read your book, and we can get it just about anywhere. Now, thank you for being my guest.
You're welcome.
It's been a pleasure. All right. Unfortunately, we're just out of time. Rick Adams, we'll see you tomorrow night, Uncensored Radio Free America. Good night.